is Japan able to bounce back from tragedy again and again? David Pilling joins us to talk about his new book, Bending Adversity, Japan and the Art of Survival.
But as a result of that historic and geographic vulnerability, somehow it's sort of primed for these difficulties that come along.
Who better to narrate their own story than celebrities themselves? John Schwartz tells us about the latest tell-all memoirs out of Hollywood as part of this week's audiobook special.
This is about being a grown-up, and he does it really well. He's a good grown-up.
My colleagues John Williams, Parle Segal, and I will chat about what's going on this week in the book business. And Greg Coles has bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. David Pilling joins us now. He is the author of Bending Adversity, Japan and the Art of Survival. David, hi. Welcome.
Hi. How are you doing?
Good. So we're speaking to you. You are now based in Hong Kong, where you're the Asia Bureau Chief for the Financial Times. But before that, you were in Tokyo.
That's right. I was in Tokyo from basically 2002 to 2008, when Junichiro Koizumi was Prime Minister of Japan. So I was there for 6, going on 7 years.
And your book begins with the earthquake and subsequent tsunami. Though you were no longer based in Tokyo at that time, you then went to Japan and reported on those events. Were you already working on this book at that time, or did this come out of that experience?
No, I wasn't. In a sense, the book was the tsunami and earthquake and nuclear disaster was, in a sense, a kind of catalyst for the book. I mean, I'd had the book bouncing around in my head for some time, but I'd left Japan by then. I'd gone on to another job. I was the Pan-Asian editor for the Financial Times, so I'd begun to think about China and India and various other places. And in a sense, the tsunami and earthquake drew me back to Japan and sort of crystallized a few ideas that I'd had about the place.
And what's the driving idea behind the book? Because you do have an argument here and several points of view that you make clear by covering not only recent Japanese history, but then going back earlier on. What is your argument about Japan and its national character?
Well, I'm sort of a little bit suspicious about sort of cultural arguments. You know, however, Japan is an island nation. It thinks of itself as a very homogeneous place. That's partly a kind of a national myth. But still, you know, you have an island that's quite far off the continental shelf. It's 500 miles from China. To put that into context, Britain is about 20 miles from the coast of continental Europe. You know, Britain tends to think of itself as quite a different place from Europe. And Japan, I think, very much thinks of itself as a different, separate place from the Eurasian landmass. But of course, in reality, a lot of its culture, its written language, its architecture, pottery, various techniques, including wet rice culture, they came from the Eurasian landmass, from China via the Korean Peninsula to Japan. So you've got this sort of slightly odd mixture of a country that certainly owes a great cultural debt to Eurasia and to China specifically, but which thinks of itself as quite separate.
Where does the title Bending Adversity come from?
It's an old Japanese saying. When the earthquake and tsunami struck, I was actually in Beijing, and I called some people in Tokyo to find out, first of all, how they were, and also to get some information about what was happening in Japan. And I had a very good friend who unfortunately has just passed away, actually. But he was he had been the deputy governor of the Bank of Japan. By Japanese standards, a kind of a left-of-center guy. He'd been quite critical of Japan in the post-war period, how Japan viewed history. You know, he was by no means a cheerleader for Japan, but he was very impressed by how Japan was dealing, or how Japanese society anyway was dealing with this kind of traumatic event of the earthquake and tsunami. And he quoted this phrase, which I translated as bend adversity and turn it into happiness. So it's really from this old Japanese phrase. I mean, just one example. He talked about in his neighborhood, straight after the earthquake had happened, you know, people had to walk home. This was in Tokyo. You know, it shook dramatically, but wasn't affected in the sense that the northeast coast of Japan was, which of course was devastated. But nonetheless, you know, all the lights went out, all the transport stopped. People had to walk home. Tokyo's an enormous city. Some people had to walk home 5, 6, 7 hours. Then they got home and they lined up outside convenience stores, 7-Elevens and the like. And he said that they lined up but only picked up one carton of milk, one rice ball, you know, one carton of green tea, one roll of toilet paper. And he was very impressed by this kind of restraint and this sort of dignity in the face of, you know, really quite traumatic events. Now, I would be careful, and I didn't present a sort of a glossy view of Japan. I know that there was obviously hoarding. There was even some crime in the northeast of Japan. But society held together extremely well, I think.
Even the phrase, even some crime, you know, is telling in itself, because in another place, in other countries, there would be no question that in a situation like this, there would be an outbreak of crime. But in Japan, it's sort of, we hesitate to imagine that would happen.
Well, that's right. I mean, it's a cliche, but cliches often have a, you know, more than the grain of truth. I mean, Japan has, I'm trying to remember, its prison population, I think it's about 100,000. It's about 1/20th of the American prison population, if my memory serves me right, you know, in proportion to the population. There's very little crime. I mean, of course there is crime. There is murder. There is, you know, robbery and the rest of it. But in comparison with many other societies, much, much less. And I think this kind of national myth, and all nations, in a sense, all successful nations, I think, are founded on myth, sort of thrive on this idea that, you know, Japan thrives on this idea that everybody's the same, everybody's pulling together, that it's a very sort of harmonious society. And while, as I say, you know, I think one can treat that with a degree of skepticism, but nonetheless, it holds true enough to have some value to talk about.
One of the cliches that you do overturn in many ways is the very broadly accepted narrative that Japan is a country in decline, that, you know, this was once the rising sun and now it's this withering nation, getting old, doing very poorly economically. But that's not true, as you point out.
Well, you know, I think it's not the whole truth. You know, Japan is aging. It's one of the oldest societies in the world. It has a fairly low birth rate. You know, clearly it was growing very fast in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and then it sort of stopped growing very fast in the 90s and 2000s. All of that's true. But I think the idea that you had this economy that was going to kind of take over the world and then disappeared from sight, I think there's a, you know, a certain exaggeration there. Neither, I think, was it ever going to take over the world and become the number one. And the most famous book written about Japan was a book called Japan as Number One by Ezra Fogel, which, funnily enough, became a bestseller in Japan. And I think that kind of set up a false narrative about Japan. And neither is the story that it's disappeared off the face of the earth true. But if you look at the numbers, I mean, after all, in the end, I think what an economy is meant to do is to preserve the standard of living of its people. Japan's population hasn't been growing, and so naturally the economy as a whole isn't growing as fast as some other countries where there's just literally more and more people. And the other thing about Japan, of course, is that it hasn't had inflation, it's had deflation. And so deflation makes the raw numbers look much worse than they are. Then actually Japan's per capita GDP has increased by about 1% a year for the last 20 years. Now, that's not China. It's not Indonesia. It's not India. But it's not that bad. It's about the same as Switzerland has done. It's about the same as Britain has done. And we don't talk about the Swiss lost decade. But I think it's partly because we had this exaggerated notion that there was this strange economy, Japan, that had come from apparently nowhere, that was building all these cars and electronics that we're going to just, you know, beat the world.
Right. I think that there were a couple points you made in the book to that end that were really striking, that China had only recently passed Japan in terms of total output, even though its population is 10 times greater, and that Japan is still the third world's largest economy.
Surely, yeah.
What is it, though, that in the face of this earthquake, of the tsunami, of the nuclear plant disaster, what is it that enables Japan to pull through?
In the phrase of another author, actually, I think it is a place that's sort of primed for adversity. If you look at where it is, you know, it sits on these fault lines and, you know, 9/10 of the massive earthquakes that happen in the world happen along the fault line on which Japan, unfortunately, sits. So, you know, there is an earthquake in Japan every day. You know, often you don't feel them, but they're there, and quite often you do feel them. And this earthquake that happened was the fourth biggest in the world. Then you've got volcanoes, you've got typhoons. Japan is sort of both vulnerable, but as a result of that historic and geographic vulnerability, somehow it's sort of primed for these difficulties that come along. And, you know, in a sense, I suppose this is the narrative of any nation state, but it has been sort of forged in difficulty. So, for example, when the black ships of Commodore Perry came along to open Japan up in the 19th century, and after all, most of the world had been colonized, but Japan reacted by sort of ripping up its feudalism, and it had been an isolated nation for 250 years, and changing overnight, a really dramatic change, setting up a parliament and becoming an industrial power, and eventually, tragically, becoming an imperial power, but nonetheless kind of changing rapidly overnight. Then again, you know, the Second World War, it was defeated, it was bombed to smithereens, and then, you know, sort of picks itself up and becomes, in a sense, the greatest story of economic catch-up that the world had seen at that stage.
Right.
But, you know, a nation from a completely different part of the world caught up and really proved that growth and development and technology were not, you know, were not only the preserve of Europe and America. And the adversity that it faces now, I would say, of course, the earthquake and tsunami of 2011, but even more historically, is the rise of China. The dangerous thing in Asia is that you've never seen China and Japan be strong at the same time. China was always the dominant power, but then sort of collapsed in the 19th century. You know, the British invaded it with the Opium Wars. Then, you know, you had Maoism and the sort of places on its knees for 100, 150 years. And that was a time when Japan was rising. But now you've got a strong China and getting stronger every day, and a relatively strong Japan, you know, and that's unique and potentially quite dangerous.
Well, it's a fascinating insight into that area of the world, and in particular into Japan. David Pelling, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
David Pelling is the author of Bending Adversity, Japan and the Art of Survival, reviewed this week in the New York Times Book Review by James Fallows. Carl Sagal and John Williams join me now to talk about what's going on in the book business this week. This was the week of many galas and events, and it's also been the week of Philip Roth.
It has been. Again, it seems like every week is Philip Roth week in New York.
In its own way.
In its own way. You can find a reason to celebrate him every week. Yeah, last night, Roth was honored by Yaddo, the artist colony upstate in Saratoga Springs, New York, with their first ever Yaddo Artist Medal. And he showed up at a gala dinner and gave a brief speech. And he talked about the time when he first went to Yaddo in the summer of 1964, when he was a 31-year-old writer, kind of coming off of a rough divorce and also rough reviews for his follow-up book to his debut, and how the place really rejuvenated him and how he really, it holds a special place for him. So it was kind of a nice look back at a very formative time in his career.
What was interesting to me was that his talk last night was so intimate and casual, really kind of, I'm just talking among friends and like-minded mm-hmm. folk. And it was a sharp contrast to the week before when he gave his last, I think, the difference is a sort of last public reading at the 92nd Street Y, which was also a lovely event, but had a very different tone to it, because at that event it was a very a kind of staged affair. Claudia Roth Pierpont, who wrote the recent book Roth Unbound, gave an introductory speech, and that was followed by a more personal introduction by Nicole Krauss, and then a reading by Roth from Sabbath Theater. There was no Q&A. There was no discussion.
Right, and no remarks from him to the crowd. Yeah, this was very different. I mean, despite the fact that it was a gala and it felt very formal, there was something very casual about him. There was a very charming introduction by Alison Lowry, the novelist, who introduced him and was very wry and personal. And Roth's remarks were similar. It is true that he said that he wasn't going to read anymore in public. And then I read this morning that someone emailed his agent this morning and said, well, he spoke again last night. And Andrew Wiley, his agent, said, well, that will be the last. That will be his last public appearance of any type. So we'll see. I think that he also...
The next time he will get on the stage and remain silent.
Yes, exactly. He told the Times a couple of years ago that he was doing his last interview as well, and he's since done others. So I think that he's a bit conflicted. I think part of him probably, after a very long career, wants to kind of recede from the scene and have some peace and quiet. But part of him is very used to being a public figure, and it'll be hard to totally cut that off.
Well, shifting to new on the scene, and I guess a look at how one gets to be someone like Philip Roth, there's a young Brooklyn novelist who's been getting a lot of attention this week. Let's talk about Adele Waldman.
So there was an interesting article in The Observer that tried to figure out why Waldman's first, her first book, which is called The Love Affairs of Nathaniel P., broke out the way it did. It sold about 40,000 copies so far, which is pretty remarkable for a first novel. And so the writer talks to different people at the publishing house. She tries to figure out why not only did it sell those copies, but it became something of like a cultural touchstone, this sort of like sociological artifact that people were reading and talking about as if it had something very profound to say about young people today and about dating and about gender and about sex. You know, I think that Ross Douthat wrote a column about it. Mark Tracy wrote a book about it. So people that ordinarily wouldn't even be discussing, one would think, you know, fiction in this sort of like raw, bloody way were really, really, really participating in some pretty interesting literary criticism.
Okay, for those people not among the 40,000 who bought the book or read it, what's the book about? What is this book?
The book is about... It's a book about Nathaniel P. And actually, I think Waldman was very influenced by Philip Roth, especially Goodbye Columbus. Mm-hmm. And Nat, he's sort of like he's your Brooklyn guy. He's literate. He's liberal. He's a little, you know, he's a little smug. He's a freelance writer on the make. And the book sort of, why did that sound so?
Yeah, it sounds like the worst thing you could say about someone. A freelance like, writer
it's
on
a
the
noble,
make.
It's a noble thing.
It
I'm
is.
Sorry.
We've all been there.
But so what she does is she portrays his relationships with women because he does have a lot of this sort of like unconscious, unexamined sexism. So why is he the one guy who's just like, you know, my relationships never work out, but it's not me, it's her. They're always too needy and emotional. But it's affectionate. She's not completely lambasting it. She really does a nice, it's one of those like very, very sort of interior novels where you really are treated to his, you know, him warts and all, how he, you know, looks at women.
And when did the book come out?
It came out about a year ago. It came out this week in paperback, which I think is why a lot of people are talking about it again. There was actually an event for it Monday night at an eyeglasses store downtown of all places, but to sort of mark the paperback release.
Which is very unusual in the book business to have a paperback release party.
It is. I think that a lot of sort of influential younger New York writers are big fans of this book, and I think the publisher also probably...
Because it's all about them.
The party Monday, it was hard not to think of it as sort of a live adaptation of the novel. There were lot of Nate types there, I think.
On the prowl,
on the make. I think it's touched a nerve mostly because, you know, written from the perspective of a woman, this is something that people like Keith Gessen and Benjamin Kunkel and a couple of other writers have done from the male perspective. But there's something about a woman so specifically getting inside the mind of this guy in a way that everyone could recognize him that I think took people by surprise and also fascinated them.
Yeah. But then I think the point that the article also makes, because, I mean, we can also say that there are so many amazing books that don't get nearly, that don't make this sort of splash.
Sure.
So what the article also says is that the publishing house got really aggressively behind this book. And what was interesting is that I mean, you're sort of seeing like how publishing is changing a little bit, or how things like Twitter and stuff are sort of changing how you position books and get them out there. They really wanted a few people to get this book, and they really wanted a few people to tweet about this book. So they were really desperate to get it in the hands of Jay McInerney. They even sent it to family members of his. They sent it to sort of anybody who would sort of give it to him. And one day he tweeted about it, and, you know, this, they
say, finally worked.
They say it started, like, things started snowballing. Lena Dunham also, you know, mentioned it. So a few people started sort of, you know, really championing this book and getting behind it.
So it's going to be the story of the future, like the influential tweet that, you know, got it onto the bestseller list.
I think
list.
That is what people want now. But I also think the funny thing about the article is that, it, you know, it's quite long and it talks to a lot of different people. And these things did happen for the book, which is great. But there's also a sense of still no one knows why this particular book this happened for. I mean, they do this for a lot of books. They get into the right hands. They try. They get people to tweet. And those books don't necessarily sell 40,000 copies or become a kind of, you know, Nate now exists as this cultural figure that people can refer to even if they haven't read the book. You know, I'm dating a guy and he's like a Nate.
The total Nate.
Even if they haven't read it.
All right. So all we need to do is figure out exactly what happened here and then replicate it for every single other book.
Exactly.
I'm
going
to go back to my desk and start.
And then we're done. All right. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Pamela.
John Schwartz is a national correspondent for The Times and also a frequent contributor to the Book Review and an avid listener of audiobooks. He joins us now to talk about the latest in celebrity memoir audiobooks. Hi, John.
Hey.
So you write about four people in this review and their memoirs. Who are the people and what are their books?
Well, Rob Lowe wrote Love Life, which is a pretty terrific memoir, his second, picking up where he left off with his first one, which I believe is called Stories I Only Tell My Friends.
I know, which like leads to so many possible jokes about the follow-up title that could have been.
Exactly right. And of course, Love Life itself is a hip fake because it sounds like he's going to be talking about everyone he's ever dated. And in fact, he's telling us sincerely to love life, which is actually kind of cool.
He's also been married a long time, hasn't he?
Yeah, he's been married more than 20 years. He's got a kid who he loves. This is a celebration of being a grown-up, whereas the first book was about what it's like to have a dissolute youth and all the fun and all the parties and all the recreational chemicals. This is about being a grown-up, and he does it really well. He's a good grown-up.
All right. Before we talk a little bit more in detail about his book, who are the other three that you write about in the review?
Rosie Perez has a book out, Diane Keaton, and Judy Greer. And all three are interesting. Rosie Perez has a life that really has to be read about to be believed. And Judy Greer is funny. She's been in 90 films and TV shows, and you probably couldn't pick her out of a lineup, even though she's terrific. Are you a fan?
I'm a total Judy Greer fan. And her book is called I Don't Know What You Know Me From, Confessions of a Co-Star. But she's always the best friend, or almost always the best friend, but she then shows up in these other roles.
Films. The Descendants.
Yes, The Descendants, which was her second film with George Clooney. She was in Three Kings back in the day, the early David O. Russell film. And just last week, I was watching Adaptation, and she had a role as a waitress in that.
She's everywhere, and she's always good. Interestingly enough, in the Rob Lowe book, Rob Lowe talks about craft and what it means to act and what goes into how it limits you as a human being, because he's a sort of emotional vampire. He says he just watches people in difficult situations and is somewhat removed from them. And then he talks about how he uses that in his own work. Judy Greer barely talks about craft at all, but she's a terrific natural actress.
Yes, and a natural storyteller. I mean, I met her at an author luncheon, and she kept the entire table of jaded journalists riveted with her stories. I mean, and laughing. She's kind of no holds barred and boundaryless, and she just kind of couldn't care less, you know?
Exactly right. And maybe a little scatological to make it, say, a Mother's Day present for some moms or, you know,
new mothers are into the scatological.
But yeah, exactly. But if it's nothing you haven't seen on cable before.
Let's talk about Rosie Perez. You said she had an interesting childhood.
Well, Rosie Perez's book starts with her illegitimate birth to a mother who had run off with a guy in a torrid affair, and the mother then abandons her with an aunt and her sister, and she's raised until three by this aunt who she thinks of as mommy, and then the mother shows up again, grabs her, and then gives her up to an orphanage.
The book is called, which I think, again, gives a little bit of a sign of what's to come, Handbook for an Unpredictable Life, How I Survived Sister Renata and My Crazy Mother and Still Came Out Smiling with Great Hair.
And all of that is in there. A lot of physical abuse that she went through, both in her home when her mother took her back and in these institutions she was put in. Just very difficult circumstances, but she's also recounting her growth as somebody who's going to be an artist.
And how did she become an actor?
Well, it's a funny path. She starts by being obsessed with music and dance and but also movies, funny movies. She loved Woody Allen. She loved Neil Simon. And she's soaking up all this stuff. She's always performing. She's the class clown. When she gets her first break, it's as a dancer on Soul Train because she's a terrific dancer.
Mm-hmm.
And then Spike Lee sees her in a club and asks her if she'd like to try out for a movie role. She sort of blows him off at first, and then her friends say, no, really, you need to do this. And all of a sudden, she's in Do the Right Thing. But the whole time, as she's bouncing like a pinball through life and, you know, bouncing off the bad stuff, finding the good stuff, she's moving toward a really terrific career as an artist.
And what about Diane Keaton? This is not her first book either.
Right. Her first book was a straightforward memoir. This is more Meditations on Beauty. And it's rambling, and it has these stretches of sort of word salad, word association, free association. But it's also peppered with funny conversations with Woody Allen and her interest in rebuilding and renovating houses and flipping houses and her life with her two kids. The problem is it's just so scattershot, it's hard to feel that there's a book there.
Well, amidst all that stuff, what was the juiciest bit?
Well, there is, first of all, a moment in talking about a very self-revealing moment where she talks about flipping the houses and going through all this and finally going to one of her contractors and saying, we really need to economize here. And he says, Diane, you're custom all the way, which is his way of saying you're a very difficult person who can't make up your mind. It's a really revealing moment wrapped in a real estate story. But
those of you who are waiting for the Woody Allen bit, disappointing.
Well, we can go back to that. But the other is this bizarre voicemail from Woody Allen saying something like, you know, I'm looking for someone stupid enough to accept an award for me. And all of a sudden, I saw your face in a beekeeper's hat. And, you know, and he goes on to say, maybe it'll help you get some roles, you know, like the spinster aunt. I mean, it's this incredibly insulting voicemail. And then he follows up with something that says, worm, call me back. And she refers to this as this funny, life-affirming, you know, funny is money, Woody moment. And you think, you have a very strange relationship with Woody.
Yes, I would say that's probably the last impression a lot of people would have of that kind of message. Let's go back to Rob Lowe, too, because there's some unexpected stuff in there, I think, about his politics, for one thing, because there was a time when people talked about him as a potential actor turned politician.
He was politically active. He was staunchly in the Democrat camp. He was he voted Democratic. And then he fell in with the Schwarzenegger crowd. He endorsed Arnold Schwarzenegger. He was very comfortable with the Kennedy family, and you know they sort of went with Schwarzenegger as well through marriage. And he sort of found himself really loving Arnold's message. And so in the book he does this little soapbox moment where he talks about feeling that that anybody who believes in only one party is it's like taking recreational drugs. It might have seemed like a good idea at the time, but that's not where we are today. It's not admirable at all. And in other interviews, he's delivered a kind of libertarian message almost about, you know, less government is best. It's a little startling to hear as compared to the earlier stages of his life. On the other hand, you know, somebody who doesn't change isn't very interesting.
Okay, I'm going to put you on the spot for one last question, which is I know that you listen to a lot of these as you're running. Which one sort of led to the most liveliest, distracting, interesting run?
So much of the Rosie Perez book was really startling that I kept running with my mouth open. My jaw would drop. but in terms of just a purely enjoyable sort of absorbing a run, Rob Lowe stayed with me best, I felt. Although Judy Greer made me laugh out loud.
Yeah, she's very funny. All right, John, thanks so much for joining us.
You bet.
That was John Schwartz, a national correspondent for The Times, covering this week in the book review, Celebrity Audiobooks. Greg Coles joins me now with Bestseller News. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
Lots of action on the bestseller list this week.
Yeah, especially on the fiction side of things. There are 8 new titles, I believe, on the hardcover fiction list. I'll just run them down. Starting from number 15, Larry McMurtry has a new novel out. It's called The Last Kind Words Saloon, and it's about Wyatt Earp and Doc Holliday and the relationship between them. So kind of an old-fashioned Western there from McMurtry, who knows a thing or two about old-fashioned Western.
Right.
Then at number 13, the Robert B. Parker Spencer series continues, although Parker died several years ago. Ace Atkins, a veteran thriller writer, has been writing the new Robert B. Parker Spencer series for the estate. And Ace Atkins has a new book on the list called Robert B. Parker's Cheap Shot. That is about a New England Patriots player whose son is kidnapped, and Spencer needs to track that down. What's interesting about that is that Ace Atkins himself is a former football player. He, in fact, I may have mentioned on the podcast before, I think he's the only thriller writer who's ever been featured on the cover of Sports Illustrated. He played on the Auburn Tigers back in the 90s, and when they had an undefeated season in 1993, he was the person that they put on the cover to illustrate that season. Then at number 12, Charlene Harris has a new book and a new series. The new book is called Midnight Crossroad. Harris, of course, wrote the Sookie Stackhouse series that became the basis for HBO's show True Blood. And her fans were very upset when she ended that series, partly because she ended the series and partly because of the way she ended it. There was always a romantic element, and Sookie ended up with somebody that a lot of fans didn't want her to end up with.
You've just ruined things for those who like have it in their Netflix queue.
Oh, I didn't tell you who. No, in fact, True Blood has diverged drastically from the Sookie books. Once they bought the rights, they kind of took it in its own direction.
And is this new series vampires also? Or
there are vampires in the new series. She's continuing with the whole urban fantasy. Although she told me, I talked to her on the phone and she said, it's not urban fantasy so much as rural fantasy. She's writing about a tiny, tiny ghost town in Texas centered with a pawn shop that sells kind of interesting things.
Rustic vampires.
Rustic vampires.
Okay.
That book, again, is called Midnight Crossroad, and it's the start of a new series. Then at number 11, Ruth Reichel, the former restaurant critic for The Times and former editor of Gourmet magazine, has a book out called Delicious with an exclamation point. That is her first novel, and it's about a woman who used to be the editor of a fancy food magazine and kind of found happiness and found who she really was once she was fired from that job.
But it's all fiction.
But it's all fiction. Then at number 10, Anthony Doerr has his debut novel. It's called All the Light We Cannot See. He's a terrific short story writer. I've followed his career for a long time, and he's reviewed for us before. This novel is a World War II novel. I'm loving it. I mean, I think it's really a great novel.
It's getting a lot of great reviews.
Yeah. Our review was
not so
less
much.
Great. William Volman reviewed it for us.
It was
us.
A very good review, but it was a good negative review.
Exactly. And, you know, I have to say I'm happy to see this book on the list. I think it's really a great book from Anthony Doerr. Again, it's called All the Light We Cannot See, new at number 10. And then up at the top of the list, there are 3 new titles. At number 3, Richard Paul Evans finishes his Walk series, this kind of spiritual Christian fiction. This is book 5 of that series called Walking on Water, in which the protagonist, Alan, finally reaches Key West, where he's set out all the way back at the start of the series. Then at number 2, John Sanford continues his Lucas Davenport series with a book called Field of Prey. And at number one, Maxine Petro and, oh yes, James Patterson, her co-writer,
incidentally,
has a new book on the list called Unlucky 13. That's by James Patterson and Maxine Petro. And that's the latest book in their Women's Murder Club series.
And there are four new books on nonfiction side?
Yes, there are. At number nine, Lynn Cheney, the wife of the former Vice President Dick Cheney, has a biography of James Madison. We reviewed it on our cover recently, and that book is new at number nine. Then at number six, Jace Robertson and Mark Schlabach have a book called Good Call. Jace Robertson, our listeners may know, is one of the sons of the Robertson family from the whole Duck Dynasty. And Mark Schlabach has co-written all of those Duck Dynasty books so far. And so he's just kind of working his way through the family now.
Ducks continue to dominate.
Exactly. This book is called Good Call, and it's a memoir of Jace Robertson's life. At number three, another memoir, Mariano Rivera, the great Yankees closer, has a memoir out called The Closer. That book is co-written with Wayne Coffey. And finally, at number two, another memoir. This one's written by Michelle Knight with Michelle Burford. It's called Finding Me. And if the name Michelle Knight sounds familiar, she is the first of the three women who were kidnapped and held captive by Ariel Castro in Ohio, in Cleveland.
Right.
And they were released just over a year ago. And Michelle Knight is now the first of them to come out with a book about the experience.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Greg.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.